This is Book Radio. I'm Mark Strass, and we're about to talk to Michio Kaku, who has just written Visions, How Science Will Revolutionize the 21st Century. Welcome to Book Radio.
Glad to be here.
You're a physicist, not a sociologist or a science fiction writer. How do you presume to tell us about the future?
I'm a quantum physicist, and I work with Einstein's theory to complete a theory of everything, a dream that Einstein had to have a theory of black holes and the Big Bang and atoms and maybe even DNA and people and life and love. However, every physicist I know has had a fascination with the future. We've always wanted to know what's the future going to be like. Well, I've interviewed 150 top scientists in the United States. This is the creme de la creme of America's scientific elite. 6 Nobel Prize winners, 15 directors of major laboratories, and I asked them one question. What's life going to be like in 2020, 2050, and 2100? And the results that I got would just blow your socks off.
Okay, well, let's start doing that sock blowing in just a second. You essentially divide your projections into three categories, which are, have to deal with computers, have to deal with DNA and biotechnology, and physics, quantum physics in particular. Why don't we start with computers, because that's sort of at the heart of a lot of this. Why don't we start in a quasi-legalistic way also by asking who wrote Moore's Law, who passed it, who enforces it, and how long can we expect it to be in effect?
Okay, Moore's Law states that computer power doubles every 18 months. So if a car, for example, obeyed Moore's Law, which it doesn't, but if it did, cars today would cost 10 cents. So you would park them and simply walk away. You wouldn't even bother to put 25 cents in the meter because cars would be so cheap.
Right, they'd be disposable.
They'd be disposable.
Right.
Now, 20 years from now, let's say around the year 2020, microchips, which today cost hundreds of bucks, will cost about a penny. Now, I repeat, microchips, the energy, the engine behind the computer revolution, will cost about a penny in the year 2020.
That's machines that can do what a Pentium II or a Tillamook or an Alpha chip can do now, or even more.
That's right. We're talking about Pentium power in your tie clasp.
Okay.
We're talking about Pentium power in your watch, in your shoes, your jewelry, in your clothes, in the walls.
Okay,
we're talking about the price of scrap paper, one penny.
So at the low end, this means ubiquitous. Cheap computing.
That's right.
Which we're going to talk about in a second. At the high end, what does it mean will be possible in terms of, in computing terms, that isn't possible now?
Well, we'll be able to do things that are beyond today's capability. For example, talking to machines, having machines recognize human
right.
speech, break it down. How many people have problems with their VCRs because they can't program them?
Right.
In the future, we'll simply talk to the VCR, and the VCR will talk back to us.
We'll talk to that now. There's a program from Dragon Systems.
That's right. IBM already has a machine that recognizes 70,000 words.
Right.
You speak distinctly like this.
Right.
And it will then type exactly what you write down. It doesn't understand, but it will simply type out what you
right.
say. It's a dictation machine.
Okay.
But that's the kind of power that's going to cost a penny. Now think about it. Scrap paper costs a penny. You
right.
scribble on it. Gum wrappers are made out of it. Scrap paper is everywhere.
Right.
Electricity is everywhere. Electricity used to be very expensive 100 years ago. And now when you walk into a room, you assume that the walls have electricity. You look for the light switch. In the future, when you walk into a room, you will assume that the walls have intelligence. You will assume that you're surrounded by intelligence because it's going to be so damn cheap to have intelligence in our toys, in our clothes, in our systems. For example, your glasses. How many times have you met somebody and you said to yourself, who is this person? I know this person. I just can't remember his or her name. Your glasses will simply scan the person's face and tell you, it's Jim. It's Jim. You met him last week at the party.
I want to go on to DNA and mm-hmm. Quantum physics. We'll cover all of that in the next 10 minutes. But I think computers is as good a place as any to deal with the issue that I think comes up in both of those. It comes up with DNA, at least. Who's going to make these decisions? Who's going to have access to this software? The picture, story that you tell in Visions about what's going to happen and how it evolves seems to me to be premised on the continued unfettered operation of what is really a machine for the production of knowledge. Do you think that it's safe to predict that kind of model can carry on for the indefinite future, or are there political, social, ecological factors that could derail it?
Well, let's not be naive about the future of computers.
Okay.
We've talked about how computers will be easy to be accessible. We've talked about the ubiquitous of it, the fact
right.
that it'll be invisible in the walls, in our clothing. It'll be everywhere. However, we're also talking about the possibility of 1984. Now let's talk about the politics of the situation.
Right.
Who
right.
controls it, who benefits from the technology, and so on and so forth.
Right.
The military originally created the internet. I'm a nuclear scientist, okay? My friends designed hydrogen warheads. My friends had first crack at the Internet. The Internet was created for people like me so that we could survive a nuclear war, so that we could then emerge from our fallout shelters and reconnect cities and have messages bypass the ruins of Los Angeles and San Francisco.
Right, or as Dr. Strange, let's say, erase a race of super people underground.
Yeah. That's right. That's why the Internet was created. However, once the cat was out of the bag, then every single person jumped on it who wanted to hack on it and create a democracy.
Right.
So in other words, the vision of 1984 could have gone that direction, but it didn't, because the cat was out of the bag, the Cold War was over, the Internet was declassified and made available to people. So I tend to be a little bit more optimistic in the sense that instead of going for a more centralized model where the CIA controls everything, they're talking about a democratic Internet.
Do you think that doing voting on the Internet would be a good liberating democratic purpose?
If it could be done in a way that has security precautions to it. In the book, I mentioned, by the way, the fact that new generations of computers are going to have to incorporate the quantum theory into them, which is my specialization, by the way. And with quantum theory, we'll be able to get anti-cryptographic systems which can defy any kind of tampering. So in the future, it's possible to get a voting system on the Internet whereby it's tamper-proof by the laws of the quantum theory.
DNA. I don't recommend the movie Gattaca because I couldn't imagine how a hyper paranoid genetic police state would have allowed one of the characters to be living with the other character from whom he was stealing the DNA in order to supposedly fool the system. But nevertheless, tell us what the power of computing has meant for the ability to decode the human genome and what that's going to imply.
Well, DNA sequencing is driven by computers. It's all computerized today, and because Moore's law says the computer power doubles every 18 months, this also means that gene sequencing doubles every 18 months, and get a calculator. You can calculate that by the year 2020, we will have personalized individual gene sequencing.
So in other words, go ahead.
You go to the doctor's office, he or she will take a piece of your skin, put it into a bread box, and boom, out will come out a CD-ROM with your name on it and every single gene in your body.
And what's going to be the use of having one of those?
Well, it's an owner's manual for your body. Your VCR has an owner's manual. Your refrigerator has an owner's manual. Everything in your house has an owner's manual except for you. You don't know that you're going to have diabetes in 15 years, that you're prone to have cancer in 25 years, or that you may have cystic fibrosis hidden in your genes. For African Americans, it could be sickle cell anemia. For Jews, it's Tay-Sachs. Or for Northern Europeans, it's cystic fibrosis. Your doctor will then give you a shot in the arm, not for measles or chickenpox. That shot in the arm will be for cystic fibrosis, to cure sickle cell anemia, to cure Tay-Sachs, and 5,000 genetic diseases, among which we now know cancer to be one of them. Cancer has now been decoded. This is something that most people aren't aware of yet. But we now know that cancer is caused by a sequence of four breaks in the DNA code, and we're going to fix that pretty soon.
Well, one of the other things that might be fixed is aging, telomeres. What are those, and how do they fit into
that? That's right. Just a few months ago, some earth-shaking news was made. For all those baby boomers who are hitting 50 now, you realize that we've located the first two genes controlling the aging process. Progeria is one of them. It's a horrible disease whereby children become aged before your eyes. They lose their hair, their teeth. They die of a heart attack by the time they hit puberty with clogging of the cholesterol. The second is for what is called telomerase. Now, every cell in your body is a time bomb. It can reproduce 60 times like a time bomb, and the fuse gets shorter and shorter and shorter with every reproduction. After 60, it's a goner. Now, therefore, if a cell is a fuse and a time bomb with a fuse, then how do you stop the fuse? That fuse we've located. It's at the end of the chromosome. It's like the plastic tips of your shoelace. Right. It's called a telomere, and we can now stop the clock. Telomerase allows you to stop the clock. Now, let me repeat this, because you may have not heard this correctly. We now have isolated the gene which will allow us to prevent the aging of cells.
Now,
this is fantastic.
You tell the story of Eos, I think, who asked that her lover be given immortality, but forgot to ask for eternal youth, and it didn't work out so well. And the person ended up as a bird or a tree?
Chattering insect.
Chattering
insect.
Cicada. Is that a problem with this, or is this going to provide eternal youth as well as immortality?
Well, I'll be very frank about this. We've now found for the first time the first two genes which control the aging process. There are probably more, and by 2020 we'll have a complete set of the AIDS genes, and we'll be able to, in fact, extend the human lifespan beyond 120, perhaps maybe doubling it. But it also means that we have to watch out for the vigor of cells, too. We have to stop the clock early rather than stopping the clock at 59,
right.
Stopping the clock early so you have a vigorous body. And if certain organs give out, we will simply grow them. We can already take a piece of your skin and grow 2 acres worth of skin from a piece of your skin. 2 acres.
So you'd want this treatment to begin sometime around 12 or 13, wouldn't you?
Well, by the time you hit your 20s, you'd want to stop the clock, right? Now, also, we can grow heart valves now. And in the future, within 5 years, we will probably grow the first liver. The liver is not very complicated, just basically one single type of tissue, more or less. We'll grow it. Kidneys after that. And within 30, 40 years, we will grow every single organ of the body except the brain.
Will this mean that hereditary diseases like Tay-Sachs and sickle cell anemia and so on will be able to be essentially deleted from the genetic stream in future generations?
We are talking about the potential of designer children.
Okay, if we can do that, do we want or can't, will we be able to make them with an IQ of 220 and run the mile in 3 minutes or 2 minutes and so on?
I think we will make children, if we so desire, there are no enormous number of ethical problems,
right.
To have children that are taller, perhaps
right.
Better looking, healthier, perhaps better disposition.
Right.
But I think intelligence is perhaps hundreds and maybe thousands of genes involved with intelligence.
Right.
And
the power of these computers should. One of the things I was a little skeptical about when you said, first you've talked about how powerful these computers are and so on, which I completely agree with, and then you sort of said that these multi-gene characteristics are multi-gene, and therefore it's complicated. You do a regression. I mean, I may be using the wrong words, but there are regression equations of some sort that can help you figure that out, can't they?
Well, certain diseases are caused by by one gene
right.
being bad, like Huntington's disease.
Right.
Other diseases like schizophrenia
right.
are caused by perhaps 3 or 4 genes.
Right, but you know, once you've created this 500,000-page book or CD with all of the genes in it, and you've got some people who are schizophrenic and some who are manic depressive and some who have sickle cell anemia, you should be able to figure out what combination of genes creates the more subtle psychological issues, problems, including mental disease, intelligence.
In principle, when everyone has personalized DNA sequences,
right.
everybody, all we do is feed all that information to computers.
Exactly.
The computer will scan
right.
for commonalities, which cannot be done today, by the way,
right.
because, of course, you know, we don't have this technology.
Right.
But by 2020, we will have all that information of personalized DNA sequencing, put it in a computer. Computer will scan for what I call homologs
right.
and analogies, and then spit out genes for aging, genes for certain forms of intelligence,
right.
genes for certain kinds of even personality dispositions.
But again, I think it's the moral or ethical or political issue that's going to arise is who controls this information, who makes
that's
the decisions.
The question.
The people who have the money, are they going to be able to pay for further strengthening of their own genetic / political position by creating children who are so smart, so good looking, so athletic, so clever at making money that will end up with H.G. Wells' The Time Machine, where we have the Eloy frolicking in Seattle and the Morlocks, I don't want to disparage any particular area, but elsewhere?
Yeah, the Morlocks, of course, had their revenge because they ate the Eloy in the end of the book, right?
That was Wells' twist.
It could be coming. We're going to have that technology in 20 years, and it means that we're going to have the wisdom of Solomon. This is the power of a god. You realize that gods have the power to animate inanimate objects, to be able to reform animate objects that already exist. We're going to have that power within 20, 30, 40 years.
Right. You mentioned God. Let me bring him into this question, picture like this. There are movements around the world, the United States not excluded, who reject the scientific method as godless and as illegitimate and as worthy of up to and including execution and elimination. Do you see that as much of a threat to the future that you're picturing here, which is generally a benign and happy one?
I think it's a possible threat because, of course, religion has always viewed, for example, the apple that Eve gave to Adam was the apple of knowledge,
exactly.
the apple of science.
Right. And the message there, obviously, is it's a better paradise than knowledge.
Right. And we got kicked out of Eden, kicked out of paradise because we bit the apple of science. And we're going to have the power of a god, and we're going to have the wisdom of Solomon. And the wisdom of Solomon is not something you can get from a gum machine by putting 25 cents in.
Right.
We're going to have to, first of all, educate the American people.
Right.
The future is coming at them like a freight train.
Right.
And the question is, will people simply lie down and get run over or put their head in the sand, or will they jump into the driver's seat?
Right.
And will they say, I want to command this technology so that the Pentagon, so that the oil companies, so that greedy corporations don't hog this and create cyber ghettos and the information elites and brain lords that suppress society.
Do you have a strategy for achieving that outcome?
The key is democracy. Democracy can only work if it is energized by knowledge, and that's why I wrote the book Visions.
Right.
The book Visions contains the best, most authoritative look, the guided tour, the 21st century that I've seen on the market. And I'll be very blunt about this. Most of the books in the future are written by eccentrics, by would-be philosophers and prophets. I've interviewed all the top scientists in this country. They are inventing the future. This is the future they are inventing.
In fact, there's a consensus. There's no real disagreement.
That's right.
What's going to be happening? How it's going to be happening?
That's right.
This is the story.
This is the consensus. When I tell people this, they're shocked because they think the future is either going to be like the Jetsons or 1984.
Right.
It's going to be neither one.
Right.
The future is a canvas that we can write on. The technology is going to be there. That's why I wrote the book. However, people have to exercise democratic control over this technology, so that generals, so that oil magnates don't make the decisions for us. And that's why we have to feed democracy with knowledge and get the democratic discussion going, and that's why I wrote the book, Visions.
I couldn't agree with you more. I'm going to cover one more thing, and then we're going to go. Tell us why the quantum mechanics part of the program. Tell us why the understanding of matter in its very smallest manifestations is a key to the origins and fate of the universe.
Well, you see, there are three pillars of science. First is life, and DNA, of course, allows us to unlock many of the secrets of life. Then there's the mind, and we now know that logic circuits that are embedded in transistors can give us an inkling as to how the mind works, not a complete understanding. And then there's matter, and we now are going to be able to control individual atoms and perhaps create matter to form. Just a few months ago, the first atomic abacus was made.
Right.
It wasn't very useful, but it was an abacus made out of individual atoms with buckyballs made out of carbon atoms as the things that go up and down the abacus. And in the future, we'll have molecular machines. Now, think about this for a moment. DNA is a molecular machine. It's like a computer tape that reproduces itself.
Right.
If we have a molecular machine circulating in your bloodstream that could recognize cancer cells, HIV, viruses, cholesterol deposits, we may be able to zap them from the inside rather than from the outside. So instead of having to open the heart up and remove clogged arteries, we'll be able to remove the clogged arteries from the inside.
So in fact, complementing the work that can be done to improve human health through genetic engineering will be nanotechnology, which will also, either at the same time or before or after, clean up what isn't being done by...
Right, and you know, new diseases like new HIVs and stuff like that could
right.
emerge from the jungle, for
right.
example, and this will be able to knock them out.
Right.
Now, remember that in my book, I talk about prototypes that already exist of all the things I've mentioned. Prototypes of nanotechnology do not yet exist.
Right.
This is still a dream that physicists have. Everything else I talked about, like penny microchips and DNA sequencing that's personalized, that's coming.
Right.
I mean, it's like a freight train. Nanotechnology is not a freight train. It's still a flicker in the eyes of most quantum physicists.
Is it waiting for theoretical breakthroughs or technical breakthroughs?
Practical breakthroughs. It's difficult to manipulate individual atoms.
Right.
IBM spelled out the letters IBM
right.
out of individual atoms.
Right.
It took a lot of work. It took a lot of PhD physicists to work out IBM in atomic form.
Right.
Abacuses took a little bit longer. But we expect that within 5 to 10 years, we'll have the first mechanical gears, levers, and pulleys that are based on atoms, and hopefully put them together in a sensing device that could be programmed to knock out cancer cells, for example.
Okay, before we go to the end of time and the end of the universe, let's get back to the beginning and tell us, people who haven't heard of it, people who have heard of it and don't know what it is, what is superstring theory and how does it fit into all of this?
Superstring theory is one of my specialties. In fact, I'm one of the founders of a branch of superstring theory. And Einstein spent the last 30 years of his life chasing after a theory of everything, a theory that would be 1 inch long in terms of its equation, but would allow us to explain the Big Bang and black holes and super colliders and superstars and what have you, and essentially allow us to read the mind of God, that in the beginning God said this equation and that created the universe. Well, Einstein failed. He failed because he didn't understand the nuclear force. But now we know the nuclear force. We have the quark model. We have atomic bombs. We have all this nuclear technology. And so that was the missing piece in the puzzle. And we now are able to then complete the dream of a theory of everything. The leading candidate is called superstring theory, and it basically says that all the matter you see around us are like violin strings. The notes of a violin string correspond to the particles of nature, and therefore nature consists of a symphony of vibrating strings. And the laws of physics are nothing but the laws of harmony of these violin strings.
The music of the spheres that the Greeks figured out.
That's why the Pythagoreans talked about this 2,000 years ago. They didn't have nuclear physics in order to complete the theory. Now we have the quark model, and now we can complete it. And, of course, superstring theory is quite controversial because it says that the universe was born in 10-dimensional hyperspace. Now, that blows a lot of minds away, unless, of course, you realize that in Twilight Zone and Star Trek, they talk about other dimensions all the time. Now, this is being considered very seriously by physicists like myself, that the Big Bang originally took place in 10-dimensional hyperspace.
And that that part of it, several dimensions collapsed and generated the 4-dimensional universe that we seem to be living in?
That's right. We seem to be living in a 3-dimensional universe with length, width, height, and depth, and time.
Right.
But you see, think of fish that swim in a pond. They're fish in a very shallow pond, have eyes to the side of their face. They can swim left, right, backwards, forwards, but that's it. The third dimension makes no sense to them. They can't even see the third dimension. But we know the third dimension is there. The third dimension is called hyperspace. Today we think that we are the fish. We're so smug thinking that we see everything there is with our stupid eyes, just like fish think they see everything from eyes that only see horizontally. And we don't realize that there's a whole new universe out there, a universe, 6 more dimensions of hyperspace, that would at some point, if we could access them, perhaps allow us to drill holes in space and time. Take a fish in a pond, lift the fish into hyperspace, and drop the fish someplace else. That is called warp drive. And warp drive does not come, by the way, from Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek. It comes from the world of physics. And maybe one of these days we'll be able to open up holes in space and time like Alice did in Alice in Wonderland.
Okay, just one or two more points. Freeman Dyson created the schema of Class 1, Class 2, and Class 3 civilizations. What are they, where are we, and where is our evolution along that continuum fit into what we've been talking about here in terms of democratic control of the scientific revolutions that you say envisions will be creating the 21st century?
Well, a type 1 civilization is a truly planetary civilization. It can control the weather, mine the oceans, get energy from the center of the earth, controls earthquakes. A type 2 civilization has exhausted the power of a planet and gets energies from the stars themselves, directly from the stars. Just grabs a piece of star material and puts it into their starships. A type 3 civilization has exhausted the power of a star and goes to galaxies and galactic clusters and of stars. Now, Star Trek, for example, would be an emerging type 2 civilization. They can barely ignite stars. They have a few planets wired together in the Federation. So that's a beginning type 2 civilization. A type 3 civilization would be like Asimov's Foundation series or maybe even Star Wars. Now, we, by contrast, get our energy from dead plants, which means that oil and coal is what we use, and that means we're type 0. We're not even on the scale of type 1, type 2, type 3.
We're as much of a backwater of a small village without electricity, telephones, or mail service as anything.
That's right. We're not even wired up to the intergalactic internet yet.
Right.
And the point is that to access the power that I just mentioned, the power of wormholes and time machines perhaps, and the ability to open up holes in space and time and bend time into a pretzel, that power is on the order of 10 to the 19 billion electron volts. It's one with 19 zeros after it. And that's mainly reserved for a type 2 civilization. If you saw the movie Contact, for example, the aliens from Vega gave to Jodie Foster a machine which would allow them to open up a wormhole in space and time, which by definition means that the Vegans were already type 2.
Right.
They already have the energy of a star and can manipulate stars at will. Let me lay out the ultimate destiny of humanity.
Sure.
Okay, this is something that usually don't talk about in your radio show.
Well, this is not a usual radio show.
The destiny of humanity within the next few centuries is to become a type 1 civilization, a planetary civilization. We see beginnings of it now. The internet, for example, is the beginning of a planetary communication net. English is already becoming the universal language of commerce and science. Even culture, for God's sake. Look at Arnold Schwarzenegger movies and Madonna. Oh, my God, think about that for a moment. But there is a planetary culture being formed.
Right.
And within about 100 to 200 years, as nations begin to lose their power, and as we have large trading blocks like the European Union, for example, emerge,
right,
we're going to gradually evolve into a type 1 civilization. However, there are many dangers because
right,
a type 0 civilization like us have discovered element 92.
Right.
Now, any civilization in space rising from the swamp will discover element 92, uranium.
Right.
It's inevitable. They go from hydrogen to helium to lithium and up to 92, which is uranium. And with it, the power to settle old racial, sectarian, fundamentalist scores with nuclear weapons.
Right.
Or they will discover what Dustin Hoffman discovered in the movie The Graduate, and that is plastics.
Right.
And with plastics comes petrochemicals and polluting and saran wrap and wiping out the ozone layer and
greenhouse effect. Not incidentally, both in Island by Aldous Huxley, his hopeful utopia, in a way, it's oil. It's the lust for oil that destroys paradise.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, today, the fight over the oil in the Persian Gulf threatens to, if not destroy civilization, at least wreak a lot of havoc in a lot of places, because we're still using, as you put it, dead plants for energy.
That's right. And we have to wean ourselves away from dead plants. We have to make sure that solar energy is going to be the energy of the future. Solar energy, by the way, is a little bit costly. And there is a problem with solar energy. There's a fundamental problem with solar energy. And that is, it's for free. And because solar energy is for free, you're not going to get a John D. Rockefeller who's going to corner the solar market and be able to harness the technology by dumping millions of dollars into it.
On the contrary, the heirs of John D. Rockefellers, in the form of various oil companies, may work, in fact, to prevent the proliferation of virtually free solar energy.
That's right. The oil companies are very much threatened by solar, renewable forms of energy. But look, that's the future. Because of the greenhouse effect, because of the fact we're going to be running out of oil in the next few decades anyway,
right,
we're going to have to go to different kinds of technologies in the transition from type 0 to type 1. Now, a type 1 civilization, for example, because it can control the weather, means there's enormous cooperation between regions of that planet, tremendous cooperation. If one country decides not to be part of a weather control system, you can't control the weather,
right?
So this means that by the time a civilization has reached type 1 status, they've already established a planetary civilization, they have conservation because they've expanded the limits of their planet. They can't go any farther.
Right. Being a Frenchman or a Frenchwoman or an American or a Mexican will have become a kind of like, I'm from La Cañada or I'm from Pasadena. Are you saying that?
Well, I'm saying that people's identities are slowly going to change.
Right.
Now, we are in the era of nations. There's no doubt about it.
Right.
I'm not a visionary that says that I'm a prophet, I can see the future.
Right.
I'm a physicist.
Right.
However, we physicists have looked at energy consumption. And at the rate of 3% increase of energy consumption per year, we will hit type 2 status in about 150 to 200 years.
Type 1.
I'm sorry, type 1 civilization in about 150 to 200 years.
Right.
And on that time scale, you can already see it beginning with a planetary civilization emerging on the Earth today. And it means that people's allegiances are going to be less and less national and more global. Now, of course, at the present time, there's only a minority of people on the Earth that feel that way.
Right.
But as John Lennon said, I'm not the only one. And the laws of economics are going to go in that direction, and the laws of physics are going to go in that direction as we attain type 1 status.
Let's say we get to pass this particular bump in the road and achieve a planetary civilization and level 2 and then level 3, and that human civilization in some form or another continues for thousands, millions, billions of years. Tell us how tunneling into alternative universes provides an eternity of reality for human consciousness, possibly.
Yeah, one of the most depressing passages in all the English language was written by Bertrand Russell, who talked about the death of the Earth when the sun extinguishes its nuclear fire. At that time, of course, Bertrand Russell didn't know about rocket ships, and he didn't know about the potential of leaving the solar system. But he said in a very moving passage, why are we shedding all these tears? Why are we crying? Why are we struggling to rise from the swamp when it's all for nothing? Nothing. The Earth is going to die. The sun is going to die, because the laws of physics dictate that. Well, we have spaceships today, but the universe also obeys the laws of physics, and if the universe also has what is called a big crunch or a big chill, then we may also see the ultimate death of intelligent life in the universe now. And it's very depressing. Why should I bother to take this physics exam tomorrow if we're all going to die billions of years from now, and it's all for nothing anyway?
And my permanent record will disappear.
That's right. And what about all my job references, right?
Exactly.
Well, it's not all for naught, because we physicists believe that, once again, if you could access the Planck energy, 10 to the 19 billion electron volts, you can open up holes in space, wormholes, perhaps to another universe. We now believe that our universe is a bubble, perhaps one bubble among many bubbles, and many physicists, like myself, use the word multiverse to connote that, because we believe in many bubbles coexisting that are having big bangs all the time. There are threads connecting these bubbles, and these threads are called wormholes. Stephen Hawking, by the way, has written extensively on what he called baby universes, and baby universes are constantly growing in a frothing of universes in a sea of nothing. And we believe that perhaps intelligent life in this universe, realizing that it's going to die, may simply jump ship and simply work our way through a wormhole into another universe.
Well, hopefully they'll be carrying a copy of Visions by Michio Kaku, saying, that's who told us we could do it, and now we're doing it. Thanks for talking to us on Book Radio.
My pleasure.